Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming. The board gaming is a hobby, all things board games, and it is a regularly scheduled weekly episode where we talk about one particular board game, and we get into the details of how to play it and the strategies in the game, and then we talk about the design of the game. So Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about 2016's Vast, The Crystal Caverns, designed by Patrick Leader and David Somerville, and published by Leader Games in 2016. This was a kickstarted board game.
Very cool.
I want to mention something real quick. So this was their first game, and Root, their second game, came out recently, and I don't think either of us have played Root. So everything we say about Vast when we talk about, like, you know, lessons learned from it is purely conjecture. We don't actually know how, you know, their experience with this game factored into Root.
Right.
I wanted to go ahead and say that before we get too far into things.
Okay. So to give a brief overview of what the game Vast the Crystal Caverns is about. In Vast the Crystal Caverns, players take one of five unique roles, the knight, the goblins, the dragon, the thief, and the cave itself. Each role has a unique action that they can take on their turn, or has unique actions that they can take on their turn, and each role has their own unique victory condition. The knight must slay the dragon, the goblins must slay the knight, the dragon must wake up and escape the cave must grow to its fullest size and then collapse, and the thief must collect six treasures from the cave. The first player to reach their role's victory condition wins. So that is the quick gist of Vast the Crystal Caverns. Each player has a unique role. There are a total of five roles. If you have less than five players, there are ways to play with less than the full number of roles. Although, I think the real experience of the game is played with all five. Unfortunately, we didn't have five players when we played the game, so we experienced the game with four roles. Each character has their own actions, their own unique way of maneuvering around the cave or being the cave, and interacting with all the other roles and all the different things that you can find in the cave, and their own victory condition, which in some cases is similar to another's, and in other cases is vastly different than other players' roles, and it makes for an interesting game. So let's talk a little bit in more specifics about the gameplay. I think in this episode we are going to just go over each role, because each role is so different from one another. We're just going to go one by one through each role and tell the listeners how they play, what their strategies would be, and how they reach their victory condition. So there is an order in this game, a very intentional order that the roles have to be played in, like a turn order. And that turn order starts with the knight, and then goes goblin, dragon, cave, thief. So let's start with the knight when we talk about the details of the gameplay. And
wait, doesn't it go goblin, dragon,
knight,
cave, thief?
Knight, goblin, dragon, cave, thief.
Yeah. Maybe
did I get goblin and dragon mixed up?
Yeah.
All right. Knight, goblin, dragon, cave, thief is the official order. So let's start with the knight. Well, I guess let's start with how the board is set up, because
yeah,
a lot of things involve interacting with the board. And the board will move and expand on its own without the assistance of someone playing the cave. So right off the bat in the game about exploring the cave and meeting adversaries within the cave, it is not necessary for someone to play the cave, because it will expand on its own. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later, especially when we get to the dragon. So so to start with, there's just the entrance tile, which is a tile with a ladder on it. And the knight is standing in the entrance. The thief is standing in the entrance. The dragon is slumbering beneath the entrance, but still considered to be within that tile. and then the goblins are hiding in the shadows outside of view, nowhere on the board. So there is the entrance tile, which is lit up, which means it's face up, and then there are the tiles are square, and each side of the entrance tile has a darkened tile covering up that side, or attached to that side of the square. It is face down, and the knight is the primary person for uncovering those tiles. So let's talk about what the knight can do on their turn. Now, Matthew, you played the knight, so you're a small expert on this topic. So I'll let you sort of go over the knight's actions and goals in the game.
Sure. So the knight's goal is to kill the dragon. They mainly achieve this by spending resources on different attributes or stats. There is movement, which lets you move up to 7 tiles. There is strength, which lets you fight the dragon and fight off the goblin. There is perception, which lets you interact with the cave and also spot the thief when it tries to sneak. And I think that's the three main ones. Mm-hmm. And then you interact with these by using grit points or grit cubes. The knight has a tracker that starts at 0 and goes to 45. And across this tracker, this tracks your grit. And when your grit reaches a certain point, you get a cube from it that can be spent on your attributes every turn in different ways, or to equip equipment that helps you out. And grit is gained in a number of ways, like exploring the cave, collecting treasures, smashing crystals, and it can be lost by a few ways as well, mainly by other players making you lose it.
Right. Just one point of clarity. So grit is a tracker, like you said. It goes from 1 to 45, or I guess it goes from 0 to 45.
Yeah.
And once you reach certain milestones on that tracker, you acquire heroic cubes.
Oh, right. It's heroic cubes. You start with 2 of these cubes.
Yes. And then you have the potential to earn 5 more. And you spend these heroic cubes to increase your movement, perception, strength, or use special abilities that allow you to interact with other other items and players.
Yeah.
So what does the knight's turn look like?
So the knight will often try to move around the cave.
Well, let's actually go in the first action you do is you pick up your hero cubes.
Yeah, you pick up your hero cubes.
Mm-hmm. And then it says you move and you act. So what does that mean?
So first of all, you can only move up to a number of tiles based on your movement. It starts at 1, and then each hero cube you adds 2 to the number of tiles up to 7.
And do you just add the hero cubes just any time during your turn?
Yeah, you put them on an empty space in the next open space available.
So
and
you
that's
can move,
the bonus it gives.
You can move 1 space to start, and then later on of your turn, on your turn, if you have extra cubes and there's some more movement that you want to do, you can add another cube to get the more movement.
Exactly.
And the movement that you have is the total number. The number that you have equipped a cube to is the total number of spaces you can move. So just to explain, you start at 1. And there's and then there's 3 more blank spaces that are labeled 3, 5, and 7. So if you've already moved 1 space and you add a cube, then your total movement is 3, which means you can move 2 more spaces.
Right.
And so on and so forth.
Right. And then when you encounter a dark tile, which is a face down tile, or you want to interact with something on a lit tile, like a treasure or a goblin or the dragon, you need to spend encounters. Mm-hmm. You have a number of encounters equal to your perception. And so normally you only have 1 perception, which means 1 encounter per turn.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to do more by like looking at more dark tiles or so forth, then you need to put more cubes into perception.
Mm-hmm.
And then strength is at 1 to start with, and each cube you add adds 1.
Mm-hmm.
And strength needs to be higher than the dragon's armor to damage it. And you want it to be high so that the goblins have a hard time damaging you on their turn.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are, if you have extra cubes you want to spend, there are four equipment you start out with as the knight on your board that mm-hmm. each help you in different ways.
And those equipment are the bomb, the bow, the ancient map, and the shield.
Yeah.
And just to describe what they do, the bomb allows you to attack the dragon while it is underground, or it lets you place a bomb token to permanently remove a wall. So the square tiles of this game that make up the cave, some of them have walls on one or more sides of them. And the cave player, as a little sneak peek into what they do, they have the ability to turn the tiles in different directions. And in some cases, the cave has the ability to completely seal off a portion of the cave, sometimes with you inside it, or sometimes with something you want inside it. Or sometimes you just need to get to a certain place on the map, and the shortest route is through a wall, so you can use the bomb to do that. Otherwise, the dragon starts the game underground, and only once they've awoken from their slumber, the way I see it, the dragon is kind of groggy or sleepy, and they need to work up their energy. So they're underground for the first half of the game, or a good portion of the first part of the game. So the bomb is used to attack the dragon then. The bow allows you to shoot goblin tribes that are far away from you, because the goblin tribes are trying to kill you. They're coming for you. And using your bow will allow you to push them back, reduce their numbers, make them flee. The ancient map lets you move through a wall, and the shield allows you to keep your ground and not be moved by other players. So the dragon and the goblin specifically have the ability to move you. The dragon wants to push you away, and the goblins want to pull you closer. So using your shield prevents both of those. And it also helps you from losing grit, which can reduce the number of heroic cubes you have and reduce your overall strength and effectiveness. There's one more thing I wanted to mention about your perception, and that is that your perception will also dictate your ability to interact with or avoid the thief.
Yeah.
The thief doesn't want to hurt you, but they can. And when they do so, they don't deal damage to your health, but they steal treasures from you. And you don't want that to happen. And they can also reduce your grit. So you can and if you defeat the thief, they drop loot for you in the form of treasures. Or no, I'm sorry. I think they drop loot in the form of giving you grit back.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you might want to attack the thief. Sometimes you might want to avoid the thief. And so your perception is also good for that. And then real quick to describe exactly what an encounter for a knight is it's not, it's more based on the square that you are interacting with and the stuff that you can interact with in the square, rather than like the number of things that you're trying to interact with in a square. So I guess to clarify, it's just, if you want to do something in a square, it only takes one encounter to do anything that you can do inside one square. So that's revealing and resolving a tile is one encounter, is part of an encounter. Resolving attacks is part of an encounter, and taking gems and treasure is part of an encounter. And doing all three of those things, as long as it's in the same space, only takes one encounter. Is that correct, Matthew?
Yeah.
Okay. So more encounters just means you want to travel to more squares on the board, and rather than you want to like attack something and pick a treasure up in the same tile. That's only one encounter. And the grit, like we said, there's it goes from 1 to 45, and you obtain a hero cube on 5, 11, 18, 26, and 35. Mm-hmm. So
it goes up by a number per increment. So right. It's plus 5.
Yep.
Then plus 6, then plus 7, then plus 8.
And then plus 9.
Yep.
All right. So Nifty. That's how to play the knight. Matthew, what are your tips for winning as the knight?
You want to try to attack the dragon from turn one if you can. Pretty much the dragon starts with, I think, no armor.
It starts with three, one armor, sorry.
Yeah.
And so, it starts with, it has five health.
Right. So it has five health, which means you have to attack it five times. With the bomb, you can only attack it once each turn.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can't attack it twice while it's underground. And so, but since it only has one armor, it's as easy as it ever is to fight it from turn one. It only takes two cubes to be able to hurt it. One to put into strength and then one for the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the big thing, is like it only gets harder to hurt the dragon as time goes on. Yeah. Likewise, though, it is really important to get your grit up. The knight has these side quests. You have a deck of them to the side of your player board, and you draw three at the start of the game. And then anytime when you fulfill the conditions on the side quest, which will be like smash three crystals or fight a goblin tribe with this much population in a turn or stuff like that. And when you complete those, you reveal them, play them, you get that much grit on the card.
Mm-hmm.
And usually this is like 4 to 6 grit. And then you discard it for good. But so this means that to get grit quickly, it's best to try and fulfill some of these side quests.
Right. Yeah. I mean, getting, especially like getting 6 grit from a single turn is a pretty big bonus. That's basically guaranteeing that you get another heroic cube.
Yeah.
And the more heroic cubes you have, the better, because, I mean, there's one thing you really need to take into account, and that is you have to move to the dragon before you can even fight it. So, like you said, it takes 2 cubes to fight the dragon on the first turn, just because it's in the same space as you. One to get the strength, and then one to use the bomb. But then every turn after that, and you only have 2 cubes to start the game, and every turn after that, it's going to take more than 2 cubes, because you're probably going to have to move more than one space to get to the dragon. You know, at least 3 spaces. As the cave grows over the game, you're going to have to probably at least move more than 3 spaces. So it's important to be consistently getting your grit up and getting those heroic points so that you have enough cubes on any given turn to move to the dragon, increase your strength to the highest that it needs, the level that it needs to be, and then use the bomb on the dragon or attack the dragon if it's that late in the game. But it seems like it takes a while for the dragon to get to that point.
Yeah, and when you attack the dragon while it's emerged, you can attack it any number of times as long as you have the encounters.
I see.
The other thing is that with the knight, you don't want to be killed by the goblins, and when the goblins get stronger, you have to keep the same amount of strength in order to protect yourself against them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another reason why, like, even if the dragon doesn't have that high of an armor, you still need a high strength to defend yourself.
So you might say that it's a good thing to get that first hit on the dragon right away. To already reduce your clock to 4 hits, you know?
Yeah.
You know, getting 20% of your goal out of the way on the first turn for like nothing.
Because the knight always takes the first turn.
The knight always takes the first turn, and the goblins are never going to be able to attack you on the first turn. So you're never going to have to worry about them, because and we'll get to why that is, but essentially the goblins start off of the board, and it takes a goblin tribe's whole turn to get onto the board before it can do anything else. So they're not going to come after you on the first turn. So you should definitely hit the dragon on the first turn. Although, when you hit the dragon on the first turn, that means you're not exploring the cave on the first turn.
Sure,
Because you're spending all of your cubes. I guess, because you have 1 cube for strength, 1 cube for the bomb. No, you do. Yeah, you can at least move one space and use one perception to encounter. So you can expand the cave at least 1 cube. Never mind. I was going to say that if the cave stays pretty cramped on your first turn, then
the goblins will have an easier time moving.
It'll be easier for a goblin to reach you.
And with that, let's explain the goblins.
If you think we've covered the knight well enough.
I guess one thing before that will still segue in is that as the knight and you're exploring dark squares, try to keep all of the spaces you explore in like the same cluster.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, don't go off on a long path. Try to explore only what's already around, like, two or three lit tiles.
Right. You want the cave to be as close to a circle as you can, rather than some kind of weird blob with long hallways and corridors and stuff like that. You want it to be one large mass of light lit rooms, because that is the safest place to be when you are facing the goblins. So let's talk about the goblins. And I played as the goblins the last time we played. So, goblins. There are three goblin tribes. There are the Fangs tribe, the Bones tribe, and the Eye tribe. Each tribe has a special aspect to them, but they all function relatively the same way. And they all start hiding in the shadows of the cave away from the board, which means that each tribe has a little token that represents it. It starts on your player board, your like placard, your tableau, and then you can take a turn to move the token from your board onto the cave, into the shadowy parts of the cave. It just moves from your board to the cave, and that takes a whole turn. And then every turn after that, now that tribe can move around the cave to do certain actions. So each tribe has a population, which is represented by a number of discs that are kept on your player board. So they're kept in one of the slots on your board that represent that tribe. So your Fangs tribe, it has a little toothy piece. Or it has a little standee that has a little toothy symbol on it. Whether that's on their player board or whether it's on the cave itself, the number of discs that are on your player board in the Fangs section will tell you the population of the Fangs tribe associated with that token. And the population is also a measure of the tribe's strength. So to attack the knight, you have to have a greater population, or rather a greater strength for your tribe than the knight's strength. And your strength is based on your population. You can increase it by having monster allies, which every tribe can have at least one monster ally. The Bones tribe can have up to two. That's its special ability. And monsters usually can increase your strength without having to increase your population. And now your goblin populations, they are constantly growing and shrinking, and they will grow every turn because let me just go through the turn order of a goblin, actually. The goblin tribes have three decks. There's the war deck, there's the monster deck, and there's the secret deck. Secrets deck, I guess, is a little less confusing. Your turn starts by drawing a number of war cards, and each war card will say, how much each of your tribe's populations increase, and then how many monster cards you draw and how many secret cards you draw. So you draw a number of these war cards, you pick one to play, and then, you increase your populations, you draw monsters and assign them to tribes, and then you draw secrets. And, when a tribe overpopulates, which is when it would go over four total population, then the tribe retreats from the board and it scatters. And then also whenever your tribes, sometimes they can get hit by the dragon or they can get hit by the knight, they will scatter then too. Scattering is a common thing amongst goblins where it will return to your board. So the token that's on the cave board, you take it back, you put it on your player board, and you lose two population. So that happens when you overpopulate, and that happens when you fail in combat. It also happens when you succeed in combat. You're kind of like a hit and run type of faction in this game. There's one other stat that's important for your goblins, and that is rage. It starts at one. It can reduce to zero, but it'll at least go back up to one at the beginning of your turn, because the rage dictates how many war cards you draw to choose from. It can go up to 3. And the things that will increase your rage are being attacked or shot by other players, using the plunder, or the fangs have a special action where they can increase your rage, killing the thief, or being affected by the dragon's hiss or the cave's sporific spores effects, which we'll talk about in a little bit. They decrease in rage whenever they attack another player or smash a crystal, or they can also spend a rage to prevent overpopulation. All right, so the strategy with a goblin, with the goblins faction, is to you want to build up your populations for your tribes, but not too much. You want to keep them at a safe distance from other players, because you can really get set back if somebody just sends your goblin tribe packing, because it takes you a whole extra turn just to put them back on the board, and you can't even do anything then. You still have to wait a turn to do something like attack somebody. And you don't want to overpopulate, because that's just setting your people back to your board and making you spend a whole extra turn to put your goblins out. Just like as if you were attacked. So you want to stay on the board with a safe population and not get hit by anybody's attacks. And then in one fell swoop, you want to jump onto the knight and hit them successfully. So hitting the knight successfully will mean being in a position where you can attack them or you can run up to them and hit them. And goblins move differently than the knight. The knight has to spend points of movement to go through light spaces, and if they enter a dark space, they spend an encounter to flip it to the light side. Goblins can move any number of spaces on their turn, especially through the dark spaces. That's where they thrive. If they move through the light spaces, they will lose population, and at a rate of they lose one population every time they exit two light spaces on their turn during their move. So essentially you just want to have either a pathway to the knight through dark spaces, or you want to have enough population and strength that you can risk losing one or two population to get to the knight so that you can hit them and then retreat. The goblins are just like a real run and gun strategy. They don't, they don't really progress through the game. Like they draw secret cards, which are little like one-time effects that they can spend on their turn. They add them to their hand and they hold on to them until an opportune moment arises to use them. So the one way that they kind of progress is that they collect spirit cards throughout the game, and they can be very useful on certain turns. But their population and their strengths are constantly in flux. I should also mention, if you scatter, you also lose any monsters that were associated to the tribe that scattered. So you're just kind of looking at each individual tribe on your turn. You're finding out like what I can do to start to build its numbers and get it into a position to attack without being too exposed to another player. And then if it's getting attacked, or if it's out on the board, you're trying to think like, can I attack the knight now, or should I spend this turn doing something else with the tribe? Because the tribes can also, they each have a secret action, which is usually either, for the Fangs tribe, they can increase your rage. With the Bones tribe, they can assign monsters, and with the Eye tribe, they can draw secrets. They can also collect treasures, which will increase their rage. I got that mixed up. Did I? Killing a thief using plunder. No, yeah, they do. If they collect treasure, they increase their rage. So you want to keep your rage up, because that is what will let you manage your population best, since your population is determined by the war cards. And if you can only draw one war card and you have to play it, that's where you risk overpopulating the most. It's just in this constant state of flux. You just have to constantly, like, every turn as the goblin, you have to look at your board, you have to see what you have, see, like, identify what you need to do, and then take care of that on that given turn, if a population is down, you want to increase its numbers. If a population is too high, you want to avoid overpopulation. If you can attack the knight, attack the knight. And if you don't have anything to do, you might as well try and do something that increases your rage so that you can have a better turn in the future. And that's it for the goblins.
All right.
So let's talk about the dragon. Okay, so the dragon, they have health like the knight. And that's about where they and the knight lose all the stuff they have in common. The dragon is asleep at the beginning of the game. They wake up by moving cubes from their sloth trackers to their wakefulness tracker. And they move cubes every time they accomplish certain goals in the game. It's kind of like how the knight has side quests, but for the dragon, it's the same things every game, the same things available at any given time. So to go over what the dragon needs to do in order to wake up, it needs to gather treasure tokens. It can gain a possible 4 cubes from gathering treasure. It needs to feed itself, which it does by fighting goblins. There's a couple of special powers that the dragon has to eat goblins. I'll explain what the powers are in 1 second. It can reveal event tiles, which the dragon has the ability to reveal tiles with its powers, kind of like the knight does. And I'll explain how it does that in a second. Or you can place a... there's 4 possible cubes from eating goblins, 4 possible cubes from revealing event tiles. Or you can place a dragon gem... where you are on the map. Dragon gems are special items that the dragon can use as temporary fuel to activate its powers. And also some characters have incentive to collect them. The dragon can, there's 1 possible cube from placing a dragon gem on the map. And there's 1 possible cube from just not moving on your turn. You need to move at least 11 sloth cubes to your wakefulness track in order to wake up. So that could mean just getting all the cubes from gathering treasure, eating goblins, and revealing event tiles, or some of those in some combination, plus placing dragon gems or not moving for the turn. So while you're moving cubes to your wakefulness tracker, you are increasing your stats. So for every 2 cubes you add to the tracker... after the first one, your stats go up. You start with the stats of 1 armor and 3 spirit, and your armor and spirit will go up as you increase your stats. Every 2 cubes, either the spirit will go up or the armor will go up. The armor is important to have high because that's what the knight must overcome in order to hit you. And then the spirit will determine how many power cards you draw. And now this is where we get into the dragon's special powers. The power cards are cards that have 1 of 3 symbols on them. As the dragon, you have a deck of cards that each card has 1 of these symbols on it. And on your turn, you draw a number of cards equal to your spirit. And then on your turn, you spend these cards to perform certain actions. So the 3 symbols are the claw symbol, the flame symbol, the wing symbol. And then you use these symbols in certain combinations to do certain things. So the claw will let the dragon attack. And that will either push the knight or it will consume and make the goblins scatter. Consume goblins and make them scatter. The flame will help you reveal spaces. And the wing is how you move around the board as the dragon. And just to go over some of these abilities, the dragon also has a special die, which has 6 faces, and on each face, it will have some pattern of squares marked in a 3x3 grid. So sometimes just the center square is marked, sometimes all of the 8 outer squares are marked and the center square is unmarked. Sometimes it makes a plus sign, sometimes it makes an X, whenever the dragon does an effect with either a single claw symbol or a single flame symbol, it'll either attack every unit inside one of their affected squares or reveal every square that is affected by the roll that they made. And then the more symbols they spend, the stronger their abilities become. They can move further or push the knight further back or reveal all surrounding dark tiles. They can create flaming barriers, which will impede the movement of other units. It'll like, I think it makes the knight lose grit when he moves through it. The knight loses 5 grit. The goblin tribe loses 1 population. The thief is killed. You are not damaged by the flame wall. You can also smash crystal tokens, and you can collapse tiles around you. The dragon, how does the dragon play? How do you think the dragon plays, Matthew? What's their strategy?
I really can't say. I mean, the dragon wants to emerge, but it takes time to do so. Ideally, you'd want to be fulfilling one of those conditions every turn.
I think you kind of have 2 goals as a dragon. Your first one is just to move cubes from sloth to your wakefulness track. So doing anything that you can on your turn to do that is important. And then the other thing the dragon wants to do is just stay away from the knight. Now, when the dragon is underground, it can move through barriers like walls, and it can traverse dark squares. So using the walls and the dark squares is important as a dragon to stay away from the knight. And if the knight is on top of you, you can spend your cards to swat him back with like claw cards can be used to swat the knight back. So you can do that. I think that's like your second goal is to stay away from the knight. And then your first goal is to just wake up. And so what you do on each individual turn is probably just determined by the power cards that you've drawn. If you can spend your power cards to like guaranteed get rid of a sloth cube and wake up more, you should probably just do that every turn. I don't see any reason to do anything else unless another player is getting very close to their win condition and you have to spend some of your turn deterring them. Otherwise you should just, you need to gather treasures. So you can, if you have a lot of wing tokens, you can just fly to a treasure token and pick it up. You need to eat goblins. So if you have a lot of claw power cards, then just swat some goblins around. And you need to reveal event tiles, which are tiles in the cave that trigger events for the night. So you just need, if you have a lot of flame cards, then just spend those to try and find those event tiles. I think at least gathering treasures is the most guaranteed thing that you can do, and revealing event tiles is the least guaranteed thing to do, the kind of the most riskiest thing to do in order to get sloth tokens. So prioritize like that if you have to choose between the two or between the three. Hunger is in the middle. It's harder to do because it probably takes more resources, I think. But because you have to move and then attack, and you have to roll the die, so there's a chance that it doesn't work. But when it does, it's useful. That actually, hunger is probably harder than pride. It's probably split. But gathering treasure is the easiest thing to do. So when it's your turn as the dragon, focus on doing that, and then keep it in your mind that you have to avoid the knight. Let's talk about the cave itself. Matthew, what does the cave do?
Okay, so the cave chooses how tiles are laid out. Or I guess more specifically, which tiles are laid out as players explore the cave. Mm-hmm. So they have a hand of like 3 tiles,
right?
And they draw from a stack. And when players explore, any empty space or any empty edges of newly revealed light tiles are given a dark tile on that edge. Mm-hmm. So if there's a wall, then you don't add a dark tile on that side. And then every turn, the cave also places an extra dark tile, or each of their turns they do this, mm-hmm. and they also place a treasure on a tile. So then there are also these crystal tiles, which are shuffled so that there's three in every third of the stack of tiles.
Mm-hmm. Total of 9 crystal tiles. And
right.
For the setup of the game, you shuffle all of the non-crystal tiles together, and then you make them into 3 piles, and then you add the crystals to them. And then to each pile, 3 crystals to each pile, shuffle those individually, then stack them up.
Exactly, yeah. And when those tiles are flipped face up, a crystal is added on top of them. These are like little tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And at the start of the cave player's turn, for every treasure you count the number of treasures and crystals, and based on that number, you get a number of omens from a bag.
Mm-hmm.
And these are like special resources the cave can spend on their special abilities.
Right. They're a lot like the power cards for the dragon, in that each omen has a symbol on it, and you spend them in certain quantities and combinations to perform certain actions.
Yeah, and I don't have those offhand, so right. You will have to read them.
So the omens are, so it looks like stalagmites and stalactites, that's one omen. There's bats, there's, I think, a stone, there's gems, there's mushrooms, and there's a pathway. And then those omens are used to perform 6 different kinds of actions. So to go over what those are, the giant bats omen can use either stalactites, bats, or a rock. It costs 1 omen, and you choose a treasure token, the knight, or a goblin tribe, and move it up to 3 spaces. So you can maneuver certain things around the board. You can, when you're the cave, you want to keep people apart from one another, because
all the other characters want to be close to each other in some degree.
Right. Except for the thief. You want people to be near the thief, I guess, so they can stop him. Because the thief is trying to collect your treasures more than anybody else. Other than that, you want people to be apart from one another because they all reach their victory conditions by being on top of each other. So the bats let you move them around, push them apart. There's the rock slide, which costs 2 omens in any combination of either the bats, the rocks, or the gems. And that lets you place a rock slide token on the edge between 2 tiles that do not have a wall. And it counts as a wall, so it lets you construct walls in the middle of the board. You can also move rock slides if you ran out of rock slide tokens. Then there is past plunder, which lets you... It costs 1 omen the first time you use it a turn, and then 2 and then 3 the next times you use it. It lets you place a treasure token. The Soporific Spores is the 4th action.
Soporific.
Soporific, you're right. Not sporific. So the Soporific Spores cost 3 omens in any combination of gems, mushrooms, or pathways. That lets you target a specific player. If you choose the knight, they lose 5 grit. If you choose the goblins, they reduce a tribe to 1 population. We played that wrong. We thought they only reduced one tribe by 1 population. No, they reduce a tribe down to 1. The dragon moves a sloth cube from wakefulness back to its sloth track, and the thief loses an upgrade but keeps the treasure token. We'll talk about what that means in a second. The target chooses the token or tribe affected. So that's just a way to directly target people and set them back. The Hatred Omen is the 5th omen. It costs 1 for the first activation, then 2, then 3. It lets you place a tile, or during the collapse, it lets you remove a tile. We'll talk about the collapse in a second. And then the Crystal Curse is the final omen. It costs either... Oh, sorry. Hatred costs either mushrooms, paths, or stalactites. Crystal Curse costs either pathways, stalactites, or bats. It lets you rotate a tile to any orientation, place an event token on an event tile without one, or move the top 3 cards of the event deck to the bottom of the deck. So you can kind of see the ways that these will allow you to manipulate the people inside the cave, create walls to block them off, or rotate tiles, especially tiles with walls, to block off parts of the cave and make it a longer trek for players to encounter one another. You can use your Spurific Spores to set people back if they're getting too close to victory or they're getting too strong for, you know, their situation. Now, the way that the cave wins is they want to collapse the cave. So the cave has a set number of tiles, and it has to play all of the tiles from its stack onto the board before it starts to collapse. Once all the tiles have been played, then tiles will not be played onto the cave for the rest of the game. And on the cave's turn, rather than placing tiles, they remove three tiles. So there's a method to the removal. They have to remove the most detached tiles first, meaning the tiles that are connected to the least number of tiles. So that those are always the tiles on the outside. You know, if one tile is only touching one other tile, you have to take that one first, then the twos, then the threes. And then after that, it comes to your choice. Unless there is a crystal tile in the running, then you have to take the crystal tiles. But this is good because the cave wins when five crystal tiles have been removed from the game. So either you've removed five tiles from the collapse, or maybe the dragon has decimated some tiles, sometimes by accident, sometimes on purpose. The goblins also have a secret that lets them remove some tiles from the board, so there's a chance that they remove crystal tiles. But in general, the way that you're going to win is by growing the cave to the greatest size and then shrinking it down and consuming up to six crystal tiles. Five, yeah. Crystal tiles, sorry. Any points of strategy for the cave?
So first of all, it's usually a good idea to place your extra darkness tile on, like, make it so that that's outcropping from the board. Think of it like you want to create a cave with a lot of branching paths and not as many clustered together dark tiles.
Right. You want separated corridors.
Yeah.
Kind of like how we said the knight wants to have everything be one big cluster, because the goblins have to go through. If the goblins have to go through a lot of lit squares, then they probably can't attack the knight. So they want to be in a giant cluster of lit squares. But the cave wants the opposite of that for a couple of reasons. But the main being, exactly what, Matthew?
So the main thing is that, wait, hold on, say that again, sorry.
What's the main reason why the cave wants to have, their tiles in long separated corridors?
Right. It's because when a new cave tile is flipped over, there is a chance that, you know, like up to three tiles will be revealed. Or not up revealed, but up to three tiles will need to be placed.
Right.
And so it means that you're going through your stack of tiles quicker.
Because every time a tile is lit up and flipped face up, the cave immediately fills it, the empty edges of that tile, with new tiles. So if a tile being flipped up and revealed only has one potential side for a tile to be added to, then that tile has a wall on it, then the person who just revealed it, who gets to choose which way it's turned when it gets flipped face up, they're just gonna put the wall facing outside so you don't get to add more tiles. But if you have these long corridors like we're describing, then there's gonna be less chances of that. There's gonna be, you know, if they're revealing a tile in the middle, there's gonna be two chances for there to be a blank space that you'll get to put a thing on. And then if it's at the end of a corridor, then there'll be like up to three chances, like you said. And you win by playing all of your tiles. And so the fastest way to play all of your tiles is to make it so that the players have to keep revealing tiles that are guaranteed to let you play more and more.
Right. And then for treasure placement, because this matters a lot, I think you want it to be closer to the knight than anybody else, but still a bit far away. The big thing is that the knight is the only one who reveals dark tiles automatically when they move at the start of the game. And they're the one that needs to reveal dark, reveal dark tiles the most. So you want the knight to be moving more than anybody else. So if you just leave the treasure in a dark cluster where the goblins can get to easily, it doesn't matter a whole lot.
Right. Now, there's only one rule when placing the treasures on your turn, and that's that it has to be in a dark space that is empty of any other pieces.
Yeah.
But yeah, if there's any such pieces or such places near the knight, definitely put your treasure there.
Yeah.
Like you said, you want to keep it from the thief, if anything, because the thief wins by collecting the treasure.
Yeah.
Is there any more points of tips or tricks? I mean,
Soporific Spores is really good.
It is really good. It costs a lot of omens, though.
Sure.
So I don't know. I think it's good.
It's like a bomb.
Yeah, it's good, but it's really only good if somebody is about to win.
Yeah.
That's the best time to use it, is to prevent someone from winning, because it is a bomb, and it's intensive for you. And you need to have, well, I guess if you have at least two or three treasures and crystal tokens face up on the, or available on the board, then you'll have enough omens. Oh, actually, that's not guaranteed, because there's a bunch of different kinds of omens. You probably have to have at least seven treasures and crystals assorted on the board in order for you to be able to consistently use Soporific Spores every turn. I guess it's kind of like the dragon, where if you can do something, you should do it, but you should value Soporific Spores over the other ones when somebody is getting close to winning. Yeah. Otherwise, use your Crystal Curse to segment and partition parts of the board and impede movement. You know, separate. If you can, you can make like a little portion of the board where nobody can reach, except for people that have the ability to pass through walls. And then you can kind of like place all your treasure over there, and keep it. It'll be very difficult for anybody else to get to it, and it'll let you keep your omen numbers up. So you can use Crystal Curse to do that. You can use Hatred to place tiles on your turn, which is probably also a pretty useful thing. The Rock Slide will come into play every now and then to make a quick wall and block some people off. I don't really see a reason to use the Giant Bats unless, you know, that's the thing that lets you move something three spaces.
Oh, yeah.
I guess you can move a goblin tribe on a, cause sometimes the dark tiles that the tribes move through can get disconnected. So they'll have to take at least like a step into the light. So maybe you can use, your forced movement of the goblin tribe to push them like across one of those, breaks in the dark tiles. To add at least just an extra thing, but that's only if they're like poised to attack the knight. That's a thing, I guess, where it's like if somebody's about to do something, you can just use that to stop it, and you've got nothing better to do. And then placing treasures, that seems like the weakest omen. Actually, I think Giant Bats is the weakest, and Pass Plunder, the one that places treasures, is second weakest. It could be useful to just kind of give yourself a boost early in the game to start accruing tokens, because I believe when you acquire a token, you keep it until you spend it. So you can collect tokens from past turns, and just getting that production up at the beginning is probably very good. But then from then on, you want to be careful with it, just so that you're not giving away free resources or helping the thief with its win condition. So with that, shall we talk about the thief?
Sure. This is getting really long.
Hopefully you guys are interested in hearing all this stuff. Let's try and do the thief real quick. We didn't play with the thief because it is suggested that with a four-person game, you play without the thief. The thief has kind of a way of interacting with everybody just about evenly, except for the cave, which everyone can interact with the thief in kind of an even way. But the thief's goal has nothing to do with the other characters. The thief wants to collect the treasures, which the cave places on every turn. They collect six treasures to win. In order to collect a treasure, they have to pick it up from the cave and then walk to the entrance with it. While they're walking with the entrance, their stealth is lowered, which makes it easier for other characters to hit them. When they reach the entrance and drop off the treasures, they get to upgrade themselves. So they have 11 upgrade slots, which they can fill. each of their stats, movement, stealth, and thievery, can be increased by a permanent plus one with an upgrade. And by the way, movement will determine the number of spaces you can move. Stealth will determine your stealth, which determines whether you can affect other players or they can affect you. And thievery will give you a number of action cubes, which you can spend to pick up treasure, pickpocket treasure from other people, open vaults for more treasure, which vaults are special tiles on the board, climb over walls that impede you, and then backstab other players to set them back, or hide loot, which will reduce your loot drop level. Now, your loot drop level is always 3 unless you reduce it for the turn with the hide loot action. And if anybody attacks you, then that number determines what they get as a bonus. So they'll if they're a knight, they'll get grit. If they're a goblin, they'll get secrets or rage. If they're a dragon, they'll draw power cards. It's pretty beneficial for people to hit you and get that loot. So you either want to keep that low or keep your stealth high to avoid that from being a problem. And then otherwise, you want to just get that treasure, pick it up, take it to the entrance, drop it off, get those upgrades. And, yeah, you want to avoid people unless, somebody's about to win, then you can backstab them. And backstabbing will either remove grit from the knight, remove population from the goblins, or remove power cards from the dragon, which is just like the soporific spores of the cave. Okay, so that's the thief. We didn't play with it, so we don't really have a good idea of what the tips for playing the thief might be. I just say work on your goal and stay safe.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a summation of the game.
Summation of the game is work on your goal and stay safe. And if somebody's about to win, you have ways of stopping them. Uh-oh, my phone just died. So I'll have to go into the strategy, or not the strategy, the design of the game blind. Without my notes.
Oh boy.
Okay, so how is the game designed? Well, it's a complicated game because it's so asymmetrical.
Dare I say it is labyrinthine.
Labyrinthine, as Matthew's cryptic tweet from earlier this week clued at.
May have hinted, yeah.
Yes, it is labyrinthine. Matthew, explain what you mean by labyrinthine.
The rules are very complex. Because not only do you have to learn the basic rules of the game, but each character has their own unique rules and terminology. And a lot of those don't actually cross over between characters. Mm-hmm. So if you want to play the knight in game 1, and then you might want to try the dragon game 2, you have to still learn quite a lot about how it works.
Yeah, this is kind of a game that you're constantly learning about. You're constantly learning when you play the game. Either you're constantly learning what your opponents have that they can use against you, or that they can do to get ahead in the game.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it, like you said, if you switch roles, then you're constantly learning everything that that role can do between games.
Just as a quick aside, it's kind of neat that that you do have that like constant learning aspect. It makes me think of a roguelike game.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, yeah, and this is, I think, like one of the biggest problems is not only are the characters so different, but they all have their own unique words you have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like the
grit and heroic cubes and stealth and
yeah, power. It's like I have a very minor list of like, let's see, where is it? I wrote these all down. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of words that you have to...
Oh, right. Grit, rage, monsters, power cards, slumber tracks, secret cards, omens, equipments, treasures, hidden, inactive tribes, upgrades, loot counters, slumber tokens, yeah.
Yeah, it's a soup of words, of vocabulary that you have to commit to memory in order to play this game. Not necessarily play it. But in order to get a good, wrap your mind around it, yeah, understand it,
yeah.
Understand the strategies and craft strategies for yourself that are more successful than others, since you're able to process the information in this game.
Yeah, so a lot of game designers will talk about elegance and elegant game design solutions.
Mm-hmm.
I think like one of the, if there's anything you can define as elegance, one of them would be like reusing words multiple times, or using parts of the game multiple times. So like in Vast, while there's things like characters can use treasures in different ways, but they all use treasures, like the knight is the only one with grit or item or treasure cards, or like the dragon is the only one with power cards. Like, yeah, a lot like of,
maybe the goblin secrets could just as easily have been called powers, although they function differently.
Yeah, but what I mean is like the glossary of terms you have to learn is so huge that it is very daunting for a new player to play the game.
Right.
I think the first time we tried playing this game, we didn't even really start it because everybody was having a hard time learning and got too stressed out for that.
Right. So the I think a big thing that causes this effect is that, you know, usually in a group of players, you'll have one person who's like the rule book interpreter.
Yeah.
Who will read the rule book and who can really quickly grasp the ideas of that are being presented in the rule book, and interpret that into how people play. And they can even kind of come up with a couple basic strategies that they can iterate to the other players as they're reading the rulebook. Like, oh, so because this is how the game is played, then we as players should be trying to do this. This game is a game where every player needs to have this skill set in order to play a smooth first session.
Right, because you have to both be able to learn your character in depth, or else it'll take too much time for one person to go for each character, and you have to be able to tell the other players how your character works so that they can make informed decisions.
Yeah, yeah. You have to have an intimate knowledge of your character, your role's abilities, and yeah, if you can't really process the rule book of a game very quickly, then this game is a little hard to play. Now, I can see why they would do that, because this is an asymmetrical game, you know, through and through. This is a game that wants each player to be doing something completely different from the other players. It wants the pieces to move differently. It wants them to interact with the different parts of the game differently. It wants them to interact with each other differently. Even to the point where, like, it wants the actions that you use to be on other players, like the action I use on the cave is totally different than the action I use on the knight as the goblin. And it's just so asymmetrical that it needs for you to have a really good comprehension skills to play this game smoothly on the first try.
And arguably part of like the appeal of board games, maybe not the appeal, but what helps them, is that one player can teach a game to a group of people, and then one of those people can teach a game to a group of people. It's like a word of mouth sort of thing, that at least, you know, you can have one person teach four people. But this completely throws that out the window and makes it so dense to try to get through. And I mean, I think there had to have been a better way to do this, but I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a lot. I mean,
I want to give an example of Android Netrunner, whatever.
Okay.
That's an asymmetric card game, and there's the corporation and the runner. They have different goals. The corporation wants to advance an agenda, and the runner wants to steal those agendas from the corporation. And the corporation sets up defenses and the runner sets up offensive stuff. And I think the big thing about that game that helps is the very basic parts of the game are the same. So like clicks are your actions for both sides. Credits are your resources for both sides. It's like these very fundamental items and objects and how they work is the same for both sides, so there it's easy enough to switch between the two, or even to just, you know, learn one then the other.
Right. It's like, and then when you compare it to Vast, the knight has heroic cubes, which they can place throughout their turn to increase their stats and perform actions. And though you compare that to the thief, who has stats, and they have 3 stat discs, they're even shaped differently, and they place those stat discs in one of their 3 stats at the beginning of their turn. So they have a 2, a 3, and a 4, and they place those in the slots for their stealth, their movement, and their thievery is the 3rd stat. So just that is different. How they're essentially functionally the same thing. You are choosing how to allocate a resource in order to increase your stats for the turn, but functionally they're completely different mechanics.
Exactly.
And that having a little bit more of an overlap there would make the game at least a little more playable and a little more easy to understand how one player works at the same time as learning how your own player works.
Yeah. or just giving characters similar stats just for the sake of being able to interact with each other. So, or maybe that's a weird word, but like, so the knight attacks the dragon with strength versus armor. Mm-hmm. And the goblins attack the knight with strength versus strength, and the knight attacks the goblins with strength versus strength. But the dragon doesn't need that to attack goblins.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and while it kind of makes sense because the dragon's big and, you know, powerful, at the same time, like, they could have given it something to make it more streamlined, I guess.
Yeah, why couldn't the armor just be called strength?
Yeah. You
know, just because, I mean, it's still functionally, at least when it comes to defending against other people's attacks, it's the same thing where you're just checking a number versus a number.
Yeah.
The dragon doesn't do that on its own, compare its armor to something else in order to perform a certain action. It doesn't need to check that in order to attack monsters. But even still, like, you could still just call it strength and then just say whenever something attacks something, its strength has to be higher than the other person's strength. That said, I mean, the thief uses stealth versus perception, so there's a slightly different mechanic there. I guess maybe it's just
but
that,
like,
if you start having overlaps, then the gaps will stand out more, or like the places where you're not
maybe
overlapping stand out more. So why not just make nothing really overlap in this game, or have just like one thing overlap per?
I was going to say, if they were to overlap things but then have something stand out, they could use that to highlight the key stuff.
Okay.
So like maybe the dragon, maybe every character has like a similar stat you can test against, but the knight's grit is still the only thing called grit. Well, that's like the knight's main resource,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't know.
Right,
it's hard to really say.
Yeah, it's hard. And I mean, you know, it took Letter Games to, you know, for a very long time, I'm sure, and a lot of testing to come to the place there are. We can hardly solve something like this in the middle of a podcast record. But I guess what we're saying is that it's important to keep this kind of thing in mind, that like that if you, I mean, you expect people to want to replay your game. And in a game like this, you expect them to want to play other characters every play session. So
I think part of it's like when you're making a game like this that is asymmetric and competitive and requires multiple players to get the ideal experience, you kind of have to do social balancing or like mental balancing, not just mechanic balancing.
Right.
I think it is good how each class can interact with or each character can interact with characters that aren't technically their like target.
Yeah.
So like the knight can hinder the goblins, of course. The knight can also spot the thief. The knight can also smash crystals and grab treasures at the cave once.
Mm-hmm.
This is something interesting I wanted to note. The overlap that does exist is the treasures. And this is more or less depending on which character, because like the goblins don't really get a whole lot from treasures and crystals. And some get more, like that's the thief's goal. But I think it's interesting how the cave is the one who doesn't want to steal treasures, obviously, because they give them.
Mm-hmm.
But all the other characters benefit in some way from grabbing treasures.
Right. That is nice. I almost wish that was like grabbing treasures was even more beneficial for each class. Sure. Like the knight, what you get, like,
it gets a lot of grit.
It's really good for the knight. It's really good for the dragon because it gets closer to its victory condition. It's really good for the thief. I guess it's really only not so good for the goblins because collecting a treasure only gives you rage, which is useful, but there's other ways of gaining rage. Especially one tribe can just gain one rage without having to do anything.
Sure.
Or, you know, without having to collect the treasure.
Sure.
Maybe if it was just like two rage for the goblin and it made it that, then there'd be a little more contention over that. I guess that's a good thing to have that contention because, like we said, in this game, it's usually the strategy of every player to stay away from each other until they absolutely have to engage. And the cave wants people to separate as well, just so that they're not getting closer to their victory conditions. But then these treasures become something to kind of work towards, move towards. Yeah.
And speaking of which, I think it's nice that they do have an automation for the cave.
Yeah, well, they have kind of a slight automation for every class.
Right.
In some way or another. They sort of do. Depends on the combination.
For some classes, for like the goblins, the knight, yeah, the goblins and the knight, if the target for that class isn't in place, so for the goblins, if the knight isn't there, and for the knight, if the dragon isn't there, don't they have just a unique objective, like getting crystals or something?
Let's see. So the goblins, if the knight isn't there, then they go after the dragon.
Okay.
Then if the dragon isn't there, they go after the crystals.
Okay.
And then for the knight, let's see. If the dragon isn't there, then you have to smash crystals, then escape the cave.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that's the process.
Yeah. And I think so. I kind of understand from reading through things and seeing things that part of the goal of this game was to make matchups different. So like if not all five characters are in play or not even all four, it seems like they wanted to still make interesting matchups that weren't lopsided towards one character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of why I think it makes sense for four of them, except for the cave, to have interest in treasures, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because like it gives them something to compete when the cave isn't there. Honestly, I'm surprised they recommended the not thief to be, or the thief to be the one to take out in a four player game instead of recommending that the cave gets taken out.
Yeah.
Just because like the cave, it seems like the cave automates better and still exists for its role, and the thief being in makes the ecosystem even if the cave isn't played because the cave automates.
I guess I can see that, like it's a kind of like a selling point of the game, at least, or a point of interest of the game, that like it's a game where you explore a dungeon and one player plays as the dungeon and they actually have a pretty active role in the game. But it's also when someone's not playing the cave, then the whole thing about reshaping the cave and rotating the tiles and creating walls and stuff like that doesn't become a part of the game. There's probably a lot more engaging with other players. I guess at least you have the ability to, when you reveal a tile yourself, to orient it in a certain way. But you'll probably end up with generally the same shaped map every game when you're not playing with the cave, versus when you're playing with a game with a cave, you can have a really weird looking map at some parts of the game, which can be interesting. But
maybe I was going to say, maybe without the cave, cards that rotate or abilities for other characters that collapse or rotate tiles are better, because everybody's going to put the tiles in their ideal formation. But I don't know, because I mean, that would, you have to play this game a ton of times to really understand every single part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, like I said, it's like an ecosystem. Everything interacts together in specific ways, and when something isn't there, it's completely different, it feels like.
Yeah, your priorities will shift entirely. I think if we had the thief in the game, we definitely would have probably concentrated a lot more on collecting those treasures.
Yeah.
And that would have interrupted how fast we got to our victory conditions, because we'd be spending parts of turns just collecting treasure, and it would also interact with how fast the cave was moving and performing actions.
Yeah. I do have a good thing to say about graphic design.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, the graphic design in this game is, I think, a pretty good strong point.
I follow the illustrator on Twitter. His name is Kyle Farron, and I think his Twitter handle is D20 plus modifier. He has some really good illustrations. I really like the little doodles he posts every now and then. Like you said, the game Root came out recently. He did all the illustrations for that, too. And then he also recently did illustrations for a Dungeons & Dragons-like card game called Dungeon Panic, I think, or something. It's some kind of card game about chaos. It's kind of like Munchkin, I guess. I haven't looked into it about what it does, but he did the illustrations for that, too. Yeah, he has a real cool style, and the graphic design complements it very well by just being very minimal and having like the same kind of illustrative quality to it. The titles of cards are written on scrolls that I bet the illustrator drew himself.
Well, I was going to say, one thing I like about it is each character is given a color that represents them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a motif.
Right.
And all their pieces are this color, including stuff that they leave on the cave. So like the dragon gems that the dragon leaves around are red. And the bombs that blow up walls with the knight are yellow.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the dragon's pieces are all red and the knight's pieces are all yellow.
Exactly. It helps differentiate who cares about what.
Yeah.
Also, something I realized, there's no blue character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because it would have blended in a lot with the purple cave.
Yeah. Especially if you're colorblind.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
I do like, and the player boards are all very clear as to what they do. I think they keep certain elements separate, when they should be. Like the knight's grit is as far away from the knight's stats as possible, because you're going to be putting a lot of tokens in the stat line, and you're going to have a number of tokens in the grit tracker for you to collect. So it's good that those are kept separate.
Yeah.
Similarly, it's good that the sloth and the wakefulness trackers are next to each other, because you're moving things from there to there constantly back and forth. That's just sort of like it explains to you, like, you're going to be moving things back and forth from these a lot, and it's important that you do that. So we're going to put them right next to each other.
Yeah. That's the most I can say about the graphic design, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to say about the game? This is, I believe, our longest episode ever.
Yeah, so I think altogether, the last thing I have to say is that this game, I think, just bit off more than it can chew.
It was an ambitious idea. This kind of asymmetrical game.
Yeah. With this many differences between the characters. And as much as I like it, it's hard to say how much they could have streamlined things without it getting muddled, or like without the main concept of the game going lost.
Right.
Yeah.
And
again, like I said, I haven't played Root, but I'm interested to, as well as interested to play their next vast game.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just want to see what all they've learned from it.
Right. And everything said and done, everything that we've said, taken into account, I'm still interested to play this game again and to try the other characters in this game. The goblins were kind of fun. I had fun, you know, amassing my troops, striking, and then having to retreat and grow again and plan these crazy turns with all the secrets that I was collecting. But I'd like to see what it's like to play the cave or the dragon or the knight, and see how I would tackle the task of completing my special goal while avoiding the other players.
That's the one benefit, is while the game is very hard to grasp at the start, after playing it with just one character, I'm interested in playing all the others.
Yeah, which but you just got to get through replays. That first yeah. hump of actually playing through a whole game and seeing
it's like,
what
it's
the
like,
different characters
it's
do.
It's like a difficulty cliff, but once you get over the cliff, it's a little easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so that is our episode on Vast the Crystal Caverns.
Fun times.
I guess check out Android Network Runner. It's a two-player game that is asymmetrical. Or I think you could also check out Spirit Island. It seems like a game that has about the same level of complexity, except it's a cooperative game instead of a competitive game.
Oh yeah, Spirit Island's a good example of this.
And in Spirit Island, at least there's a bunch of overlap from character to character, so you can grasp what each character does on your team when you play a game or in between sessions. But the characters are complex enough that it's hard to completely understand what your allies can do in that game.
Yeah.
So it benefits from the complexity there. So that's our episode on Vast the Crystal Caverns. Thank you for listening. Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
If you'd like, you can like, comment, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can also leave a comment, follow our podcast feed on whatever podcasting platform you'd like to. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we post all our episodes, and we tag them based on the games we talked about. We did an episode on Spirit Island. We mentioned it briefly here. If you want to check it out, you can go listen to that episode there. If you want merch, you can go to tpublic.com/user/bgbcast. Or sorry, is that right? Let me double check the messages. tpublic.com/user/bgbcast is where you can get our merch.
We have t-shirts.
We have two t-shirts there.
Yeah.
Get yours. Matthew plugs. Yeah.
Also, I am streaming on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Standard Time to, what would that be, 2 p.m. Central Time. And I've been speedrunning a game called Hob. I will more than likely be playing the new Smash Bros. So, yeah, come by, stop by, chat. Get to talk with me about whatever's on the mind and
join the Discord.
Yeah, we have a Discord server.
Yep.
All right.
Check it out. And if you made it this far into our longest episode yet, we appreciate it that you listened, and stay tuned for next week's episode, which probably won't be so long.
Yeah.
All right.
See ya.
Thanks for listening.